and welcome back. Today on the IBS Freedom Podcast, I am joined by Amy Hollenkamp, R.D. to the max.
Hello.
And I am Nikki. I always forget to introduce myself, but I'm Nikki, by the way. And today we are talking all about something that is important in any healing journey. And also, I would say, for just overall baseline health and happiness and longevity. Amy, you want to reveal our topic? Well, I guess if people clicked on the episode, they know what the topic is. Damn it. No element of surprise today. Yeah, you can do the big reveal anyway.
Yeah, we should do like a surprise topic.
I mean, we like could do it mystery. For this episode, but yeah, mystery topic. And then we could trick people into listening to it.
Yeah. Big reveal as the title.
Dun, dun, dun.
We're becoming clickbaity. That's our new thing.
You know, we've got to get to the million subs.
Right.
300 subs on YouTube or something
so
like that. I don't know.
We're going to talk about the mindset journey that, or just like mindset issues that we see within our own clients in their healing journeys, and how, and strategies to potentially help make sure your mindset's in the right place through your journey. So, you know, it's so interesting. I recently, actually yesterday, I had a call with a client, and I'm sure you have calls like this where the call is mainly mindset stuff. Like, there's a lot of mindset coaching that I do, and some people need a lot more mindset coaching than probably even the physical type coaching or like the science-y, nutrition-y type coaching. Actually, like, a lot of their hangups could be more the mental side of things, and there can be a variety of different areas we could delve into from, like, we've talked a lot about, like, the food mindset and that sort of thing, but even just like how they're generally approaching their day-to-day and how they're conceptualizing their gut issues in their heads, how their self-talk, you know, their gut journey to life balance. So how they're balancing everything in relation to their life. These are issues that I see all over the place. And I really think that the mindset piece is huge for people. And usually the people that are in a better headspace are gonna progress quicker and more efficiently than those that are in a, pun intended, shittier mindset.
Crappy mindset.
So it's very interesting to me, like, you know, working with clients that need a little bit more mindset help, because it can create a huge difference once we make progress in those areas. And it's the piece that's just not quite there. And then once you get it there, it's like a lot of other ducks fall in a row. Is that similar to your experience with clients too?
Yeah, I think, what is the saying? I'm going to butcher the quote, but there's some famous quote that you see on memes and stuff on the internet all the time. But it's basically, whether you think you can or you think you can't, either way, you're right.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, if you think that you can heal, or if you think that you can achieve optimal health, you will. If you think that you can't, then your mind is powerful enough to keep you stuck. And, like, I want to make a point, too, early in this episode of saying two things. A, we realize that sometimes this is a catch-22, right? Like, a lot of people have depression and anxiety and mental health struggles in part because of the stress of their healing journey and how sick they are. And some people have that as a manifestation of their dysbiosis or their SIBO, because the gut and the brain are very much connected. And it can feel like, oh, I just need to heal the gut, and therefore the brain and the anxiety and the mindset stuff will kind of fix itself. And there is a degree of truth to that, but I think what we're talking about with quote-unquote mindset actually kind of goes beyond simple anxiety or depression. But I do realize that mental health and gut health are very much interconnected, and sometimes it'll feel like you're in the middle of a really crappy catch-22. You look like you're going to say something.
That's a really good point. And I will say, too, that probably the clients that are coming to you and I are clients that have been around the block for a while. So they've been struggling with SIBO or IBS for a decent amount of time, and they've tried a lot of different things. So to me, it's not a huge surprise that there's some mindset hangups, because maybe they were really hopeful and like, oh, heal at the beginning, and they took some wrong turns, and it's created more of a barrier to be like, oh, well, I've had all these issues for so long. I don't even know what my life looks like outside of this. So,
or just, I think a word too is defeated. A lot of people are very defeated.
Right. That's a really good way of simplifying it. Yeah, I think there's a defeated aspect of it. And I feel like I've been there too, like personally, like in my own journey. I mean, probably the first year of my journey was just a big debacle. I would say there's not much of a better word to describe it.
I can think of a better word.
What is it?
Clusterfuck?
Oh, yes! There you go. Okay.
Was it clusterfucky?
Yeah, it really, really was. It was very much about restrictions, about very aggressive treatments, and it was doubling down on these things. So I think the strategies in place weren't really setting me up to succeed. So there's an aspect of that where you need to have the strategies in place that are going to set you up to succeed. You need to have strategies in place that are addressing your root causal issues. But I think what I realize, and what sometimes I'll tell people that are in that mindset too, sometimes it's okay to just, one thing I did was just, I kind of took a break for a period of time. Like, you know, maybe a couple months, 2-3 months, don't try anything really new. Maybe do some really like maintenance thing. Like, I know this thing helps and this thing helps. I'm just going to like stick with this and kind of manage things for a little bit because I need like a SIBO break.
Yeah.
So to speak, before I can engage in something, like I need to take a mental break before I can dedicate commitment and time and energy to embracing my gut journey again. And I think that kind of stuff's okay. Like if you're in a really like not a great headspace and you've kind of just gotten out of trying something and it didn't really move the needle at all and it's kind of a bummer.
Yeah.
Even taking a step back and maybe taking a break from doing anything really actively can be helpful as a reset.
And almost like mourning the experience.
Right. Right.
Like, and again, like probably most everybody goes into a new experience or a new therapy or a new relationship with a practitioner with a great deal of optimism. And then, by the end, you're kind of defeated and bummed and feeling hopeless. So it's kind of okay to mourn that and like acknowledge it was what it was and like gear up for the next phase of things. I think that's actually a really good point. And there's another thought too that I wanted to bring up early on, which is also there's a really fine line that we're probably going to straddle a little bit here. And again, like when we talk about mindset, that can almost be like a little triggery of a word for some people because it oftentimes mindset comes up and it feels like the people are just telling you, act happy no matter what, act optimistic no matter what, kind of like fake it till you make it, right? Like even if you're depressed, you have to act undepressed. Or even if you're anxious, you have to like put on this show for the world and pretend to be a person who's not anxious. And it can feel really like crappy and inauthentic and frustrating. Right. And there's a fine line. I think there's a fine line between like fake it till you make it being something that you are not versus, I mean, I guess some of it would fall into fake it till you make it. Like doing a gratitude journal and writing down things that you're grateful for, even when you're so burnt out and frustrated and depressed and anxious and mentally spent, and you're like, I literally can't think of a single thing I'm grateful for because my life sucks right now. Even if you can think of one thing, like, oh, I love my pillow. That's the comfiest pillow. Or like, I have clean water. And I know it sounds corny and like, it sounds on the surface like it's belittling your problem and it's belittling your experience of it. But honest to God, just picking some stuff that you're grateful for and just reminding your nervous system that you do have things to be grateful for, I think will draw more good things into your life. But it, like I said, it can feel a little bit yucky and a little bit foreign and a little bit dishonest because I think, you know, it's, well, you fill it. I think I've said all I can, but it's a fine line with the fake it till you make it kind of element to this.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a fine line to like with emotions. I know what you're saying. It's like the typical expression, oh, I'm fine. Like, it's like, what does that even mean?
Yeah.
You know, like, when someone asks you how you're doing, like, and it's interesting because I wrote an article on my blog, and it's called The Importance of Moving Through Grief and Pain During Your Healing Journey and How Swamping Can Help. So there is a book by Regina Thomashower. Her nickname is Mama Gina. But she kind of talks about how to, like, move through your emotions. So, like, as they come up to, like, how do you actually express your emotions? And she calls it swamping. So it's, like, different activities you can do to kind of embrace your emotions and move through them. So then you can get to the other side of kind of where you're at. And everyone's going to be a little different. So I don't know if this strategy is going to work for every single person.
Can you give, like, a for instance?
Yeah, so I can, I pulled this up. So she talks a lot about, like, rupturing, like, when you're in grief, like, a state of grief, like, allowing yourself to kind of rupture so that you can move through it and move past it. So she's talking about an instance where she was upset. So she says in this book, I decided that instead of hiding my emotions inside, which is what I had done my whole life, I would instead wear them on the outside. Truth was, I felt like garbage. So I went to the kitchen and I pulled out a black trash bag. I pushed my head through the top, punched my arms out through the sides until I was wearing it like a dress. I tied a babushka on my head and went to the fireplace and wiped some ash on my face. I blasted loud music and stomped around, pounding pillows. She said, as soon as I did this, everything about my internal chemistry changed. I began to feel delighted with myself instead of hating myself. Having my outsides match my insides felt celestial. It gave me a whoosh of energy. It was also hysterically funny, and yes, I felt divine. When my roommates began to trickle home, they were all very entertained, and so was I. I was proud of myself rather than ashamed. I ended up gathering a whole line of swamp clothing, including a Psycho Bitch from Hell t-shirt, camo pants, and biker boots. I began to notice that the more I greeted my inner bitch with warmth, love, and honor, the less frequently she visited. All she ever wanted was to be heard and to be given a proper seat at the banquet table. So it's kind of like the idea of it is that you can, like, if you're upset or angry, it's not to necessarily ignore those emotions. You want to acknowledge that they're present. But then I think, again, like something we talked about with Dr. Julia King, which is the even though exercise, like, it's okay to be upset or be angry about something, but it's not the only thing that's happening. So, like, even though you're, even though I'm really upset that I didn't make progress, I'm happy that I was able to try that strategy out. And I know that it's not the right strategy for me, or I was really able to enjoy the movement of that program, or balance out the negatives with the positives. But I like the idea of being able to kind of move through different emotions that you're having. And so in that article, I talk a little bit about, like, my own, that period where I sort of took time off and had to sort of grieve. I like that you mentioned the grief part of it, where I had to grieve just, like, the loss of that period of time where I felt like it wasn't really helpful. Yeah.
Or, like, the loss of the optimism that you had at the beginning of that journey.
Right. Right. Exactly. And it helped me to reevaluate, too. Like, you know, it almost took me, which I think is the point of this article and, like, the swamping mentality of it. Like, I feel like there was a very, like, grievy part. I was almost weepy. Like, I had a lot of, like, depression during that time period. Mm-hmm. And it almost, like, took me going, like, to just kind of allow myself to feel those emotions to then I could move on and reevaluate what was happening. Mm-hmm. So reevaluate, well, why didn't those strategies really work? And that was really a pivotal point of my journey, because I was able to see, well, these strategies didn't work because they were very surface level. They didn't go deep enough. And it really allowed me to see different things. But, you know, I think, again, I allowed myself to move through the grief I was having. And that helped me. It illuminated some things once I was on the other side of that grief.
Yeah. Well, it's almost like if you're objectivity and your judgment is clouded by grief, disappointment, frustration, shame,
right?
You know, sadness, whatever the emotion is, if that's clouding your judgment and clouding your objectivity, your best bet is to just let those things do whatever they want to do, like experience those things and let them fade away. And then once right. you're in a better mental state, then you could probably look at it from a couple different angles and see, like you were saying, like, oh, this didn't work, probably because X, Y, and Z reason. And now that I'm not in that, you know, desperate, shameful, et cetera, whatever right. mental space, now I can see that more objectively.
Right. And one tip she'll give, Regina Thermashower, so she talks a lot about, like, moving through your emotions musically. So, like, if you're upset, like, pick kind of a heavy metal song or something and kind of, like, rage to it. Mm. Or, like, if you're kind of sad, like, pick a sad song and kind of sit with that song. So you can kind of dance with it. But, like, kind of moving your body physically with emotions seems to be a powerful way to help you, like, move through them, if that makes sense.
I can see that. Yeah, I could see that. And I know there's even some theories that, like, stress and trauma are, like, stored in the body, quote unquote, like in the muscles or connective tissue or fascia. I think I haven't read the book. All right. Confession. I don't know about you. I have this bad habit where I will purchase books and I'll tell myself I'm going to read this book and then I don't.
I'm the same way.
And you know, it's dumb. And again, I feel like you're probably my kindred spirit on this. I will go on PubMed and I'll open up 8,000 tabs on my computer and I'll download and read a million different PubMed articles. But when it comes to getting like a paperback book or a just like a normal book, even if it's clinically relevant, like I have a copy of The Body Keeps the Score, which is the book I was going to mention. I've got a copy of The Holistic Psychologist's book, and I love her Instagram feed. Like, I have books from people that I think are legit, and I want to read them, and they could be applicable to my work or my personal life. And I don't, by the time I kind of get to the part of my day where I theoretically would read something, I'm just, like, crispy. I want to watch K-pop videos and dream about dancing as good as these K-pop stars. Right. And I don't have the mental capacity for anything else right now. But hopefully that'll change. But The Body Keeps the Score, I believe he talks about that concept that, like, stress and trauma is literally stored in the body.
Yeah.
And it makes you think that, yeah, getting physical somehow, or doing a physical modality even, like chiropractic adjustments or acupuncture, could help release some of that stored trauma.
Yeah.
I know I was talking about this with my group with FODMAP Freedom, I think 2 weeks ago, because we got on a tangent about, like, stress and trauma and emotional health. And I mentioned that there's a chiropractic technique where I've never experienced it, but basically, like, they couple the chiropractic adjustments with some sort of attention or some sort of work on whatever trauma you've experienced. And I think the idea is that it helps, like, release the trauma from the body somehow. Again, I don't really know because I've never had that technique done and I've never taken the class. But if anyone's curious, it's called neuro-emotional technique, NET. And I've been told by some practitioners who practice it that it can be really profoundly helpful. So maybe kind of along the same lines. But I like the idea of dancing and just moving your body and working out too.
Yeah. 'Cause
I think that'll have additional benefit, you know, cardiovascular and nervous system benefit.
Well, and I think that it's a way to honor your emotions versus trying to shut them out. Because there's, I think that if you're trying to be, like, you know, 100% positive all the time, but you're feeling frustrated, like, if you're like, oh, I have to be positive, and you're not honoring, like, maybe how you're feeling in that moment, it's draining. So, like, to try to be positive and shut out emotions, it's kind of like, I'm going to shove down these emotions because they're not good or something.
Yeah.
Versus actually just kind of like, oh, yeah, I am, like, really sad, or, like, I'm, you know, really upset about this. Like, how can I move through this? And again, I think that dancing, again, she describes that a lot. She also describes sometimes, like, physically, like, punching something, like, not a person or anything.
Yeah.
We don't want to get in trouble for violence.
Not your spouse. Yeah.
Right. Not your spouse, but, like, punching something, or she would sometimes talk about, like, a pillow, or, like, I don't know, she would describe maybe using like rags to like smack something. Mm. Like just like the physical activity of like kind of releasing tension like that. Mm. But I think that that is a really interesting premise. And again, I think kind of sitting with your emotions can be valuable because it can help you kind of release the tension versus trying to avoid it all the time.
Yeah. Well, so, it's gonna come out eventually in some way. Right. And it's a matter of if it's voluntary or involuntary on your part, I guess.
Right.
But you touched on something that I think will be applicable here. You kind of lightly touched on just the idea of just acknowledging the emotion, mm-hmm. And again, like allowing yourself to experience it. I think I told you this story, I think, prior to our last podcast recording, but I don't think I told it on the podcast. So I was telling you how I started doing hypnosis, right? Did I tell you a story from that?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And one of the weird things that happened from it, I only had the one session, but it was wild and very good already. She was doing like kind of a guided meditation of sorts, like getting me into a relaxed state, doing a body scan. And maybe like 5 or 10 minutes into that, I felt really heavy. Like it was like somebody turned up the gravity 50-fold, or like the density of my body was like 50-fold denser than normal. And I felt that from basically like my pelvis up to my lower jaw. And she was encouraging me to give her feedback throughout the process. Like, oh, if you see a color or if you smell something or if you like feel something, tell me about it. And it took a little while for me to muster the ability to tell her about the heaviness because, again, my jaw, like my mandible felt really heavy. But finally, I was like, you know, I just was able to tell her I feel really heavy. And I remember thinking, honest to God, I had my hands on my stomach. And I remember thinking, I don't think I could lift up my hand. Like, even if I wanted to, I don't think I could lift up my hand right now. This is kind of freaky. And it was like, 90% of me was fascinated and along for the ride. And then 10% of me was kind of getting a little bit scared because it almost was like bordering on, I almost feel paralyzed. And it was really intense, but I finally was able to articulate that. And she was like, okay. She said, I want you to acknowledge the heavy feeling. Like in your head, just in your head, tell yourself, I feel heavy. I acknowledge the heaviness. So I did that, and I felt 10% lighter. Right away, like that.
Right.
And I was like, okay. And I was able to tell her, okay, I'm a little bit lighter. And she said, good, do it again. So I did the exact same thing. All I did, it was in my head, I was verbally acknowledging, I acknowledge the heaviness. And as soon as I did it the second time, I got another 20% lighter. And she said, good, do it again. I did it again, another 20%. And we did that 4 or maybe 5 times, and the sensation was completely gone. But literally the only thing I did was I thought to myself, I acknowledged the heavy feeling. Mm. And that it was like, and it started to lift off of me. So, you know, I don't know how to psychoanalyze that or what that all means, but it was really profound. And like I said, I went from, I don't think I can lift my hand up if I wanted to, like it feels like my arm is made of lead right now, to going back to feeling pretty normal. And then we were able to continue with the rest of the hypnosis session, but it's kind of, I experienced a very like acute version of what you're describing of like, you know, you could acknowledge, I feel sad, or I feel shameful, or I feel, you know, frustrated or whatever it might be, or I feel really desperate, like I just need something, anything. And like just acknowledging the way you're feeling is a step in the right direction, and letting your body kind of begin the process of processing that, if you will.
Right. It's like you're validating how you're feeling when you're acknowledging it. And I believe that sort of allows your physical body to relax a bit. But yeah, I think that it can be an important part, and it could maybe allow you to get over a hump. Like I think the grief example is really a good one to think about. It's like sort of allowing yourself to grieve, or like, you know, like certain situations, even like if someone dies. I know, like personally, I've had like a few closer relatives pass away, and it's like some moments you're like totally fine, and then the next you're like, oh, it like really hits you.
Yeah.
And it's mm-hmm. like, I think some people, and I think I've been guilty of this, where I'm like, ugh, like, you know, I don't feel like doing this right now. You know, I'm going to like save this. And then it just gets stored up. Mm-hmm. And there's some people, I think, especially in past generations, I think we're a little bit better as time's gone on to sort of recognizing that, like, you know, crying and things like that isn't like a weak thing.
Yeah.
I think there was like stigma around that sort of thing. You know, I think the biggest example is the expression, like, don't be a crybaby, that sort of thing. So I think that it's getting better over time. There's less of a stigma around it. But I feel like there's some older people, like people in older generations that have like never really grieved appropriately for a loss.
Yeah. Oh, I believe
And it's
it.
Like there has to be tension and stress stored because they haven't acknowledged like their true emotions and feelings. And I think that takes its toll over time.
Yeah. Well, you can almost just imagine like a little cloud of energy for that emotion or that grief in this case. And you can imagine like you could either let it out and it can exist out in the world, in the space, in the air, or it can find a place to hunker down in your body and set in the tissues. I think that makes sense, at least for me and the way I kind of process the world. So it would make sense.
Yeah.
But well, now, go ahead. No, you first.
Oh, I was just going to say, and you brought up a really good point earlier that we can kind of veer back into with like the power of belief.
That's what I was going to say.
Really?
We were really? Going to say the same thing. Oh, cosmic litter mates. Okay, continue. I wanted to acknowledge that we both were going to say something and it turned out to be the same thing.
Well, and I think that like, you know, going to like a reference, have you read Bruce Lipton's Biology of Belief? I know you're not.
I probably have it on a bookshelf somewhere.
Okay.
I've heard of it for sure. And I may or may not own that book, but no, I have not read it.
It's a popular book. And it basically makes the case that, you know, a lot of conventional medicine views us as like very chemical beings, like hormones and different chemicals are interacting. And that's what causes most of the reactions in our body. But there's less attention on like the electrical, like we're electrical beings and like thoughts and feelings are going to produce different electrical changes in us in a much faster way, much more quickly than like chemical changes happen. But just how our thoughts and beliefs affect our biology, and a lot of that's more of an electrical change than a chemical change. There's certainly chemical aspects of that, but it's very, very interesting. And just some of the examples he gives are really interesting in that book. But I think that the premise is that your beliefs and thoughts affect your biology. So like if you believe that, he gave some example in the book, I wish I had it in front of me, where like some guy got diagnosed with cancer, like gastric cancer.
Uh-huh.
And he turned out to be misdiagnosed, but he still passed away. Like he still like believed himself that he had like 2 weeks to live.
Yeah.
And he passed out in that time frame.
Yeah.
But it turned out he was misdiagnosed and it was like something way more benign, like treatable. And he gave kind of multiple examples like that. Like sometimes, you know, there's a lot of mystery still, I think, in how much our thoughts and beliefs affect our biology. But on our past discussion, you know, it might take getting through some grief periods to be able to reframe your mindset, like I was, to be able to reframe my mindset of getting hopeful again and like believing that I could get better and believing that I could move forward. And again, like maybe that's a good initial step if you're sort of like struggling. I think there's a couple things that you could do, but even just like believing that you could progress could be a good, like maybe it's not like get to perfect gut, like maybe that's too big of a leap for you, but even thinking like, oh, I could get to this point, like I know I could get to this point, like even whatever that intermediate step is, maybe doing that. And I also think visualization can help, like if you've been having gut issues for a really long time, some of my clients, I'll literally have them visualize what they want to do when their gut issues are better, more manageable, like not something that's deterring their life. Like if gut issues weren't a major issue, what would you be doing?
Yeah.
So I'll have people visualize that. And I think that that can be really helpful because it gets them outside of it. It can help them actually see it, like a fake it before you make it type thing, but in your head.
Yeah.
And I think that that can be a really helpful thing, like almost a manifesting, manifesting success.
It's interesting because we're kind of at like the crossroads of two kind of topics where, I'll say this and we'll get into more manifestation stuff momentarily, but I remember my college coach telling us, before a big race, he was like, I want you to like sit in your room and visualize winning that race, visualize winning the Dad Vale. And having, you know, meters and meters and meters of open water between you and the other boats and just like kicking total ass. And right. I remember I remember he told us that on multiple occasions. And every time I just kind of like internally rolled my eyes and I was like,
right.
No, like that's not going to do anything, Andrew. Get a grip. Come on. And I never did it. And now the more I learned about this, the more I'm like, oh, no, that was a good idea. And I realized, like, if you think it's bullshit, just Google, like, athletics and visualizations, because a lot of top-notch athletes do this before they go into, like, a world championship or an Olympics or something like that. Like, you can't expect to be Simone Biles and just go in there and have, like, a 10.0 performance when your nervous system is not totally prepared for that to be a reality. So it's funny because I thought it was bullshit. I thought it was like this hokey make-believe thing. And now I'm like, oh, actually, no. Like, this is something that a lot of top-tier athletes do. And, like, it actually has its basis in neuroscience. And, like, one kind of nerdy way to wrap my head around it, because sometimes, like, I need to think through things in this way to get the rest of my nervous system to believe in it. There are a lot of pathways in the nervous system, particularly with the cerebellum, that, you know, we think of the cerebellum as being like the coordination and movement part of the nervous system. So like if I was to juggle or ride a bike or walk in a straight line, heel toe, that would be the cerebellum that's ultimately helping me do those tasks and planning that motor function, that movement. But there's an entire immense amount of circuitry that's involved with motor planning, but those pathways don't actually move your muscles. Like it's just a loop in your nervous system that is going through like, okay, then I would move my ankle this much, then I would point my toes this much, then I would do this thing, and then I would do this thing. And it's like, it's rehearsing. It's literally your nervous system rehearsing all the steps of what you would need to do to execute that physical thing that you're imagining doing. So it makes sense that we could do that broadly with emotions and other experiences. Like your nervous system is just rehearsing it and making sure that it knows what to expect. And then by the time you go do the thing, you're well equipped to do the thing, right?
Yeah, I think the way I like to term it, and this is pretty much exactly what you're saying, it's like a dress rehearsal for your nervous system, so that your nervous system isn't going in like, oh, like I'm a little tense, this is a new thing, or like I'm not familiar with this at all. And I think, you know, there's, I think his name's Joe Dispenza. He might be a chiropractor too. He talks about this a lot in some of his books, but, you know, and I think he even mentions like, they'll look at the brain, like it looks like in the brain when someone's doing a visualization that it's actually happened. Like the chemistry in the brain is very similar to like how the brain chemistry would light up if that was a real thing. So it is like this dress rehearsal in the brain, and it can be really powerful. And it might seem weird at first. I was just talking to my client yesterday, who literally we were talking through this. She feels like she's going to be stuck with gut issues forever. Like we were literally talking through this, and she's like, you know, I'm trying visualization, but she's like, it just feels like I don't believe myself, or like if I say a mantra or something, it feels like I'm not believing myself, or if I'm doing a visualization. And I'm like, it's not going to feel natural, I think, at first. Like, again, you as a college athlete, it's funny you say that, too, because I was taught that with free throws, like basketball free throws to imagine, like when you're warming up, to imagine the swish of the net.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not going to be a really natural thing if you've never meditated or if you've never, done a manifestation or visualization before. It's not going to be a natural thing.
Yeah. You're going to feel like a fraud for a while, probably.
Right. And even like some people will do mantras. I think those could be helpful too. Like each day, just saying, I will get better, doing everything I can to move the needle. I trust my gut's going to get better. Like saying those types of things, some people really value. And like, I think she was doing some of that. And she's like, I just don't believe myself. But it's almost like a faking it until you make it. Like it gets more natural. It feels more habitual over time. And it feels like, I think, again, it becomes a practice. It's not necessarily something that right away people are like, oh my God, I love. Some people do. Some people love visualization right away. But
I think it's kind of like meditation or yoga. Like, okay, the first time you do yoga ever, you're probably going to suck at it. But then as you do it for longer and longer, you get more flexible, you get more strong. Like, it's just like any other skill that you develop. Or like you've been saying, you are learning guitar right now. The very first time you picked up the guitar, you probably sucked at it. I say that with love, but it's true. And now you're getting more and more skilled. And soon you're going to be putting on acoustic guitar concerts for all of us to hear. And you're going to ditch me on the podcast. You're going to be like, whatever, lady, like my CDs are selling like hotcakes. Are there still CDs out in the world? Like, is that still a thing or is everything just digital?
I will say, I get very upset about that.
CDs?
Well, because I have a whole bunch of old CDs, like from like high school and stuff. And there's no, your car doesn't have a CD player anymore.
Yeah, it's the world we live in. Well, I will raise you that. And I will say, I just showed Jess the first Harry Potter movie last night. She loved it, first of all. Second of all, I'm pretty sure I purchased that DVD in like 2004. But the joke is on the universe because I was Googling like, where could you stream Harry Potter? Like, is it on Amazon? Is it on Netflix? And I forget now where it was, like Paramount or some shit like that. It was on a subscription service that I do not have. And I was like, oh, that's a bummer. And I thought about like downloading it as an individual movie on Amazon. And I remembered, I bought the DVDs for the first two Harry Potter movies back when DVDs were the thing. And like VHS tapes were kind of on their way out. And then I think my mom might have the movies 3 and 4. So I think we're good for a while. And I don't have to worry about streaming Harry Potter for quite some time.
Oh my God.
We're
going
to try to milk the one movie as a parenting strategy.
Right.
We'll show her one movie and then we'll try to milk that one until she kind of is getting sick of it. And then we plan on like months from now, we're going to be like, oh, do you want to watch the second Harry Potter movie? And she's going to be mind blown and be like, oh, there's another one. That's the strategy.
I can't wait for that. Well, and I do think too, with visualizations, the one other thing I will mention, the last thing I'll really mention is that another thing that like I picked up from Joe Dispenza's work is matching the visualization with the emotion that you would feel if it was a reality. So he talks about like gratitude being usually an easier emotion for people to like sit in with a visualization. So let's say you're trying to add in new foods, or even like generally from a gut health standpoint, if you're trying to imagine that you're what life's like outside of major gut issues, like let's say your gut issues are under control, what does your life look like? So you're visualing that, like, who are you with? What are you doing? What's your day look like? But as you're kind of going through it or towards the end of it, like really trying to imagine how you would feel if that was a reality.
Yeah.
I think can elevate it and help the nervous system even more.
Yeah, that makes sense. And again, it really goes back to the dress rehearsal idea.
Right.
Of like, let your nervous system rehearse the experience first. Let me tell you this. This is semi-related, I think. It's close enough. Did you ever follow the work of, oh gosh, what was her name? Yasmina. She called herself the low histamine chef.
Sounds for a really number familiar. Of years.
She had the website healinghistamine.com, I think it was. And it's still up. Like her websites are still up. She passed away a few years ago, unfortunately. But she was like probably the single biggest internet influence on like the low histamine diet and histamine intolerance, mast cell activation kind of world. And she has all of these great low histamine recipes and ebooks and all sorts of blog articles and great stuff. And I send a lot of my patients to her website when I start talking to them about the histamine thing. And I happened to stumble on this years ago, and I have it saved on a YouTube playlist. But she did an interview years ago on a podcast. It was the Fat Burning Man podcast, funny enough. And she was just talking about her experience and the histamine stuff. And God, I didn't realize how sick she was, first of all. And I didn't know she was a reporter, and she was overseas in the Middle East reporting on like Iraq and Afghanistan during all of the really intense times in like the early 2000s and like I think maybe the 90s. So she talks about, you know, and she would just soldier on, and she thought she was tough and that her body just broke and she couldn't handle stress anymore. But she went into full blown like numerous anaphylactic food allergies, mast cell activation syndrome, like all sorts of really squirrely stuff that took a toll on her body. But she talked about when she was at her worst and her most unstable, she almost died because she went into anaphylactic shock after eating one strawberry. And luckily, like she was around people who had like an EpiPen and they were able to save her. And then after a number of years and doing a lot of work nutritionally and trying to add in a lot of variety and a lot of antihistamine kind of foods, and after she not only became a big fan of meditation, but she actually became a meditation teacher and was like teaching workshops, she said she actually got to the point where she voluntarily, she sat down, did a meditation, ate an entire bowl of strawberries, and then meditated again and had absolutely no reaction whatsoever. And she talks about it in the podcast episode. She was like, no, I'm not saying to do that willy-nilly because like she had been training herself in meditation and practicing very diligently for many years. And she had done a lot of like root cause type work. She had really honed in on nutrition. She had done a lot of the work on herself up until that point. And she said she actually had a physician and a couple of other people like in the room with her when she did this, so that if she did go into anaphylaxis, they had EpiPens and drugs ready to go to save her. But she talked about how so much of it for her was mental, even though she had a diagnosable disease. Like, and that's the weird thing about mental health too, is that you could have a diagnosed disease. You could have Crohn's or celiac disease or Hashimoto's or whatever it might be. Like, you could have an organic manifestation of the illness, and you could have positive test results and inflammatory markers and autoimmune markers. And she did, she had full-blown mast cell activation syndrome. And I forget what else she struggled with, but like she had a diagnosable clinical illness and diagnosed confirmed food allergies. But one of the things that she credited for a lot of her healing was the mindset piece of it, and really honing in on believing that she could heal and meditating and training her nervous system so that her nervous system believed that she could heal. And ultimately she was able to reintroduce this food that years ago would have sent her into straight anaphylactic shock. So it's pretty wild stuff.
Yeah. Carol, it's wild. Go ahead.
Sorry, I interrupted you. You were trying to say it was wild, I think.
Yeah. I think it's wild, and you don't want to underestimate how much the nervous system can affect function and affect your ability to progress. I think too, like I know we've talked about this a bunch too with the negativity in like forums. Like one thing that's going to send your nervous system into a tailspin is Karen on a SIBO Facebook page telling you all the foods you need to avoid. And you're never going to heal if you eat this food or that food, or no, you're doing this wrong. So, or just telling you how horrible their experience is and that they're not healing.
I will actually do a test. Let's test Amy and I out and see if we are full of hooey. Hold on. Okay, I think this one will do. And side note, I did a YouTube search, Fat Burning Man low histamine. And mm-hmm. that podcast episode is the very first thing to pop up on YouTube. So, and it's, the thumbnail is a picture of Yasmina, like, cooking and chopping something in a very comical, it's a very faked pose for sure, but she's pretending that she's chopping something. So for what it's worth, you can look that up. Yeah, the Facebook groups, I really cannot stress enough how counterintuitive they, or how counter they are to your healing. I got told today on Instagram, somebody commented, because I did a reel and I mentioned supporting HCL, and somebody said, well, I heard recently that HCL feeds SIBO. What do you think of that? And I commented back and I'm just like, I think that is 100% false. Yeah. Like, I don't, that, like, where'd you hear this? But anyway, right. This is the sort of stuff that you see in these groups, and it's presented as like, here's this piece of the puzzle that nobody else has told you. But let's see if you and I are full of shit, shall we? So I pulled up a unnamed Facebook SIBO group, and I'm just going to do a quick look-see-loo. All right. In order, the most recent posts. Sorry for the TMI, but my stool is an olive green color. It's worrying me. The person's taking biocidin. Okay, so that's like a general, has anybody encountered this type of post? Another post, I'm so confused. Finally found a practitioner, got the GI map done. And now I'm hearing this GI map isn't accurate. Spent $400 on it. All right, that one's a little boring. This one.
But I even think like these still reinforce like a level of confusion and like,
yeah,
you know, anxiety. And I think again, like there is a just a general theme, even in the posts that aren't outright like desperate sounding. Because again, like, so I think a lot of people with gut issues do have some desperation. I know I did. But totally. Like when you're seeing that all the time and it's just like reinforcing your own.
Well, and that's
your own mindset barriers. When it's reinforcing your own mindset barriers, it can prevent you from reassuring yourself and building trust in yourself. It creates more confusion.
Yeah. Well, and I think it also paints this picture like if you especially, pardon me, heaven forbid, if you follow these groups on Facebook, like it's one thing to be a member of the group and unfollow it from your newsfeed. But if you scroll through your newsfeed and all you're seeing is Candida groups, Hashimoto's groups, SIBO groups, IBS groups, holy motherforking shirtballs, in the words of Eleanor Shellstrop. Wow. Like it's going to give you this illusion, and your nervous system is going to interpret this as truth. It's going to give you the illusion that everybody has gut problems and it's very chronic and very severe and it's lifelong and there's no hope. Nobody's finding solutions. And it's giving you this illusion that you're in a room full of people who have these problems. And it's becoming this kind of echo chamber for all of your worst thoughts and all of your worst fears of like, well, oh, and this, you know, I can't trust anybody when a practitioner recommends a test because, see, that person spent $400 on a GI map and then found out it wasn't accurate. And this person says X, Y, and Z. And this person, it gets really overwhelming. And it, honest to God, it really sends a very scary message to your nervous system. Like, right. You're surrounded by this and that there's no escaping it. I even, I don't know about you, but I have a Facebook group for my course. And right in, like, I call it module zero, but it's like the first couple of videos of FODMAP Freedom. One of the things I mentioned to people is, please go on Facebook and unfollow all of your Facebook groups that you're in and just follow the FODMAP Freedom member group for right now. Right. Like, just, you can still be a member of those groups. And that's great. Like, you can still be in there. And you can still look at the posts if you want to, but don't have it in your newsfeed because it's just going to poison your mind and drive you crazy. Yeah. And you don't need that. And so that's actually something I have people do right off the get-go in my course even.
Yeah. And I think the hard thing is as humans, we're designed to try to connect.
Yeah.
And I feel that when you're having gut issues and no one in your general life or is it really having like the issues you're having? Like there is sometimes this need to feel like, oh, I like want to be a part of a community. I want to connect with people that are going through what I'm going through.
Yeah.
But it's like so hard because in particular, those Facebook groups tend to be the people that are more chronic.
Yes.
And have been struggling it for more intensely. And there's just more of a negative connotation to to the talk in that group.
Yeah.
I think you're much better off, honestly. Like, one thing that helped me was there was a girl locally. I called her my gut buddy. She went to the same first functional medicine group that I went to, which I ended up not really liking that much. And I think she was like disillusioned too a little bit from the practice. It was sort of a practitioner that didn't have much of a bedside manner and like didn't really adjust things very easily, but that's nor here nor there. But anyway, so I met Christina. And sorry, Christine, not Christina. What am I saying? Christine. So I met Christine. I haven't talked to her in a little bit. I should reach out to her. But we went to the same clinic and we started talking to each other. Mm-hmm. But it was very much like an authentic thing where like I could see where she was progressing in certain areas, but like we could still like commiserate on areas that we were struggling with. But it was much more of like a balanced discussion.
That micro scale, I think, is better too. Because again, it's like I said, with the groups, it feels like it's you plus 14,000 of these sick, miserable people.
Right.
And it gives you the illusion that the problem is that much bigger and that much harder to solve. Versus if you're just talking to one other person about it, you get more of that, dare I say, personal touch and like more. You can have a better connection with that individual person and really get more of their backstory and more, you could be privy to more information with that individual potentially. And also, like, I think it's healthier for the body and for the nervous system if it's like, oh, me and this one friend are going through this versus me and 72,000 other people are going through this and there's no hope and we're all doomed and look at all these chronic sick people. And this is why people ask me all the time, is it really possible to cure SIBO? And I'm like, hell yeah, it is.
Right.
Like, don't let the groups fool you. Like, I know that it looks like that group has 14,000 people and that group has 7,000 people and that group has 8 million people. But like, that doesn't mean that all of those people are doomed to have SIBO forever. Like, yeah.
Right. Well, and I feel like, too, it was more... again, a good way to put it is nervous system balancing to talk to that one friend. So I sometimes I'll recommend people try to find like a gut buddy of some sort, either asking like if you're working with a practitioner, if again, this is a little tricky, like, you know, tell them that you're looking for someone to just kind of support you in a way, like a little bit of like a support group, but maybe it's only one or two people.
Yeah.
Because I think that that can be valuable to where you're getting like a connection where you might not feel as alone in your experience. Because I think that that's hard to deal with too, but it's more of a balancing conversation. I remember with Christine, we would talk about Little Debbie's, like how we ate terribly as children. We're like, this is why we have these gut issues. We just ate like Little Debbie snacks every day of our lives. And we didn't eat like any, like as much vegetables as we needed. And so we'd always like,
it was like a running gag.
Right. It was a running joke about like Little Debbie's destroyed our guts.
Yeah.
You know, like damn Little Debbie, you know, it was like kind of the end of most text messages, you know?
And see, that's the sort of thing, like, even if you are really frustrated that day, like, it's that little kind of, like, little joke fragment that can help you kind of keep the energy and the atmosphere a little bit lighter and a little bit happier, even in that, like, small, seemingly insignificant way. But yeah, I think that support either, you know, from your provider or from somebody else, I think that can go a long way. But yeah, it's like one-on-one or even... like three people could work. Like I'm thinking like in a business group, we had, we were set up with accountability buddies in pods of three and that still worked reasonably well. And we could talk about like what we were kind of working on. But yeah, I feel like you wouldn't want it to be really any more than two or three people. Cause then, and you know, and with Facebook groups to beat a dead horse yet again, I think that those groups encourage people to post something when they want something or need something, right? Like, again, like my stools are green. What does this mean? Diagnose me, please, Facebook people with no medical background. Not that I blame that person, because again, I get the desperation. I get why they do it. But like, you know, it encourages people to just be like, oh, I've got to type something. and that it feels like you're getting support, but people are just typing a sentence or two or three in passing. And like, it's very surface level support. It's very just like, you know, whoever happened to see your post in their newsfeed and felt like replying on that day or had something to share with you, versus having a conversation is completely different. Even though social media is built to fool us into thinking we're having conversations, it's just, it's different. Yeah.
Totally.
I don't know. I could go on about the toxicity of Facebook groups all day.
Right. Well, and I think too, one thing you mentioned a little bit, like even support from your provider, like checking in on that as well. Like, I think sometimes people start losing faith in their provider. And like, I believe you should air what your concerns are with your provider and like give them the opportunity to help kind of calm any doubts you have or fears that you have. Like, that's normal, like for you to maybe question something or be confused about something. But I also think that at times, just working with clients, that like frustrations started earlier, like where they felt like lack of support by a provider and they didn't change gears quick enough, or like what I might consider quick enough, like staying with a provider that's not supportive.
Yeah.
Can sometimes create more stress and prevent progress. So like sometimes I think it's good to just like check in, like, is the provider I'm working with the right fit for me and giving me the right support? Do I trust the process with this provider? Like, do I feel like there's a clear process that I'm working through? That kind of stuff would help, because I think sometimes what happens is things aren't going well, or like you're concerned or having doubts about things. And then there's no trust in the process after that point. Like, you kind of lose faith in the process. And either something needs to happen where you talk with the provider or change something up to where you get faith back in the process, or maybe you need to do your own internal work. So it might not be provider related at all, but you know, I think looking in at the provider is a good thing. I don't think you can blame everything on the provider at all. I'm not saying that, but it's more like if you're not having the most faith in your provider, that could be creating more doubts and more losing trust in the process even more. And sometimes it helps to like evaluate if the provider's the right fit. And again, maybe the provider is the right fit. It's more of a mental struggles you need to move through, but filling your provider in on where you're at so that they can support you or provide some guidance might make sense. And then I think there's also situations where maybe a different provider might be a better option so that you're trusting the process more.
Yeah. I just remembered a nugget that I think will be a good addition to the conversation, but I have to skim for it for a second and find it.
Okay.
Get this. So I saw this on Instagram randomly the other day. I also want to just briefly mention that a lot of bullshit mindset issues can also be because of societal kind of pressures and what we grew up being told was normal. So like, it's normal and it's socially acceptable to not tell people when you're sad or angry or disappointed or desperate or frustrated, etc. It's normal and it's socially acceptable to stuff your emotions down and put on a happy face and just like go to work, go to school, do whatever. It's much harder socially to show your emotions and tell people when you're pissed at them, tell people when you're disappointed with them, and like air your grievances. Like, that's really frowned upon, especially, heaven forbid, if you're a woman, because then you're labeled as a bitch, which is ludicrous. And like, oddly enough, like, I've lived so much of my life in fear that somebody would call me a bitch. I don't know if that's like all women or if it's just unique to me, but like that's like a worst case scenario in my mind, oddly enough. And it only in recent years I'm realizing, like,
yeah.
But like, there was this post from Beth Rosin. She's an RD, and I saw her. The caption is, so it's a conversation. She says, "Me, Grandma, I got you dessert. Here's a piece of cake." Grandma, 101 years old. "Oh, I shouldn't. It's fattening." Me, "Grandma, you're 101. You win. Eat the freaking cake." And I commented back, like, You win, Grandma. Seriously, diet culture ruining lives right up until the end. And she said, and with severe dementia, diet rules is all that she remembers. It's like,
oh my God,
this is so depressing. But, you know, stuff like that, we don't realize how deeply embedded it is until we kind of read something like that. And it's this holy shit moment. Mm-hmm. But you are not put on planet Earth to please other people or to be skinny or be beautiful or be funny or be smart. Like, you're just here to experience human life in whatever way you want to experience human life. End of story. If you want to be like wicked accomplished and rule the universe, like I think my child will someday because she's capable of being a dictator. Cool. If you want to just like watch Netflix and sit around in your jammies and live a happy life in your jammies watching Netflix, cool. As long as you're happy. But like, right. don't let society tell you that you can't eat the cake because it's fattening, or that you're not allowed to cry, or you're not allowed to, I don't know, like the list goes on, right? Like, food is right. allowed to, you're allowed to enjoy the taste of your food. You're allowed to just do something because it's fun and for no other GD reason. Right. You're allowed to do something irresponsible every now and then. You're allowed to disappoint other people sometimes. Like, it's cool. Life will go on. You'll live. But so much too of like the societal pressures. And I feel like it almost dovetails into some of the conversation with healing the gut. Cause like, I think shame is a emotion that we don't talk about enough in the world.
Right.
And like a lot of SIBO protocols, especially, it points the blame and it puts shame on the individual of like, oh, low FODMAP, you're low FODMAP and you're doing antimicrobials and you're still bloated. You must not be doing low FODMAP strictly enough. You must not be doing it good enough. You must not, you know, you're not looking for your root cause hard enough. You're not doing this hard enough. And like, you're, you know, it's you. You're the problem. This is why you're not healing. You need to work harder. You need to dedicate more time to this. You need to spend more money on this. You need to do this. And it's like, there's so much shame in the healthcare world, especially with chronic illnesses, especially with illnesses that are not well understood by conventional medicine. Like, I've had numerous patients straight up like go to their doctor and either be directly told or it's insinuated that their IBS is all in their head. And anyway, I'm going off on a big tangent here, but I thought it was relevant.
It is. And it's funny because I think I mentioned to you, I had a client who was getting like injections in her back. I believe some sort of injections in her back. She has some back problems. And the doctor she's going to put her on an insanely strict diet. It's gluten-free, dairy-free, like lectin, like just bunch of different everything other stuff, like nightshades. Like it's eliminating a lot. And she like came to me after we've been working together, we're trying to like diversify her diet. And she, I mean, luckily she was in a good headspace. She was kind of laughing. Yeah. She's like, there's no way I can do this. And the guy who she's working with basically said if she comes back and they didn't work, it's because she ate gluten. It's like, no, it has nothing to do with maybe the treatment not working. Gluten is to blame for it, and she's to blame because she ate the gluten. Yeah. Like, it's just, it's insane, I think, some of the mentality around that sort of stuff. And I think what happens at the core is that people start losing their trust in themselves to make the decisions that are right for them, especially from a dietary standpoint. Like, it takes understanding what foods work for your body and what foods don't, or what foods you can tolerate if you're trying to have fun. Like, again, for some people, you know, having that cake is totally fine to do. Like, they're not going to they might not feel their best, but like, it's so good and delicious and, you know, they had fun eating it. They might get a little bit bloated or something, but okay, they've accepted that again. And then there's again, like in your situation, you couldn't eat a piece of cake, but you can eat other things, but you have to trust that, you know, like, oh, this is not worth, I trust that this is not worth the reaction I'd get if you ate gluten-rich cake.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is like, you've got to be smart and make good decisions when you can. But like, even you touched on something that reminded me. Yesterday, I was talking with one of my favorite patients, and she, there's been a lot of conversation about sugar for her. and carbs and how these things are not intrinsically evil or bad for her. She came in, interestingly enough, she came in to me with a bunch of stuff going on, but among them, she was convinced that she was insulin resistant. Convinced. Mm. And within the first time talking to her, I was like, no, I'm pretty sure you're hypoglycemic. I really, really don't think you're insulin resistant. Turns out I was right. She could have some pretty wicked hypoglycemia spells, actually. Low blood sugar spells. And we've been piecing this together and kind of understanding what foods make her blood sugar take a nosedive really badly. Like, she actually got a CGM and has been monitoring her blood sugar a bit with that, which was helpful. But, like, when we talked yesterday on her paper, so I have patients submit something before each appointment to kind of give me some idea of what we're going to be talking about. And on her clarity sheet, she was saying that, oh, she was bad. She caved and she ate cookies.
Yeah.
And you could tell she was really ashamed and, like, beating herself up over it.
Right.
And when I talked to her, and side note, it was her anniversary. So, like, I don't know. Right. It's a pretty good reason to eat a couple cookies. And they were gluten-free, whatever, cookies. But they had sugar. And I told her for the umpteenth time, and I think I'm getting through to her, but I was like, okay. You know, out of curiosity, how did you feel after that? Like, how did your body feel? She was like, yeah, I was fine. There was something very minor. Like, she thought she might have had a little bit of brain fog the next morning, maybe.
Right.
But I was asking, I was like, okay, so no poop problems, no bloating, no, like, weird blood sugar dips, no changes in your sleep. She's like, no. I'm like, okay, so it sounds like you did pretty okay
with it, right?
Like, I think it was okay. And she was like, okay. But she's like, but won't it feed the SIBO? I'm like, not necessarily. Yeah. Like, it's fine. It was your anniversary. Yeah. Live your life. Eat the cookie. Eat the cookies. Well, and I literally gave her an Instagram account to follow because I was like, I think you're actually going to get a lot out of following this particular account because, like, I think we need to undo some of this, like, this internal dialogue that's really harsh on yourself. And you're beating yourself up over eating a couple of gluten-free cookies and it's not the end of the world. It's not going to... You're not going to mess up your healing process or mess up your body by eating a couple of gluten-free cookies. It's okay. And you don't have to be so harsh on yourself. And I think we're starting to get to that more, but that's a very big recurring theme every time we talk where it's like, or like she was like, oh, you know, I wanted a treat and I opened up a jar of cashew butter and then I ate the whole jar of cashew butter. In like 3 days. I was like, okay, let's explore that. Like, and again, it goes back to what we talked about with Eliana, right? Like, if you're super strict and restricting yourself most of the time, eventually the pendulum is going to ricochet the other way and you're going to demolish a tub of cashew butter.
Right.
But if you can allow yourself to have treats regularly, and your body doesn't think, oh my God, I'm never going to see this food again. Like, the swinging of the pendulum will get less severe and less erratic over time, but you just have to trust that process. And maybe that means you gain a little bit of weight, or maybe it means you're a little bit bloated one day, but, like, you need to trust that process. But anyway, you were going to say something, though.
Yeah, well, and I think that it's so interesting you bring this up because the amount of people that'll say, well, I'm addicted to sugar. Like, I have cravings all the time and I can't have sugar, you know. And I think that when you have a certain craving for something, like, this is also something to think about mindset-wise. Instead of going directly to shame of, like, why am I addicted to this? Or, like, this is my problem. Instead, getting really curious about it. So, like, I wonder, like, why I'm craving this sugar, or, like, why I'm craving this thing. Because for some people, it's because they're not eating enough. Like, for most of my clients, like, it's blood sugar stuff, or they're not eating enough carbs. So they're, like, craving sugar, which is a very normal physiological response for being under calories and under carbs to crave sugar. And then again, like, for some people, it might just be that they need to loosen up their diet and have a little bit of sugar because that will help their nervous system in a different way. Like, you'll enjoy the food that you're eating, and it's fun, and it's an experience, and it's a celebration of food. So, but I think the curiosity thing, if you're someone that's going to the shame side of things, trying to go at it from a place of curiosity is a much better approach. So trying to be curious about your feelings or curious about your experiences versus coming at it with criticism and shame is a better mentality to hang your hat on.
Yeah. And I have the perfect analogy for what we're kind of talking about with, like, the pendulum swinging way over to the other direction because you're restricting. Mm-hmm. Let us take the example of the, let's see, there's so many we could choose from. Let's pick Cadbury, let's pick Cadbury Cream Eggs.
Whoa.
Let's go there.
You're going there.
I was thinking about doing the Shamrock Shake or like the McRib or something, but I figured we'll do the Cadbury Cream Egg. Cadbury eggs are only available for the few weeks leading up to Easter, right? So what does everybody do? They buy all of them. I mean, assuming you like Cadbury Cream Eggs. The normal response, if you like that thing and they're only available for a very short, finite amount of time, the normal response is for you to buy a whole ton of them. Or like, let's say Peeps. If you love marshmallow Peeps, but they're only available for like 3 weeks a year, you're going to load up and you're going to buy a whole bunch of them so you have a stash. Versus, and all of the companies that do this know damn well this is true, what would happen if you could get a pumpkin spice latte any day of the year? Or what would happen if you could get the McRib or the Shamrock Shake or candy corn any day of the year? Their sales would tank because it's always available. So there's no incentive for you to take action right then and there. It's always there. You don't have to buy candy corn today because you could buy candy corn on April 22nd or November 3rd or January 22nd. Who the fuck cares? You could just get it whenever you want. And their tails would plummet. Versus if they could create this artificial scarcity in their marketing and they could say, only available for 1 week only. Oh my God, it's a special thing. They're going to sell 10 times more of the item in a much shorter amount of time because everybody's scrambling to get, you know, whatever it is that we're talking about here. I think that's kind of analogous to what I was saying with the body. If you allow yourself to have, in this case, a pumpkin spice latte, like once a week, just for the duration of your life, you're never going to get to the point where your body is like, oh, give it all to me right now. Right, and you're downing, you know, gallons of bags of cookies. Like, you're never going to get to that point. But if you deprive yourself for a long, long time, and then you just like go off the rail one day and you're like, oh, I'll have a cookie, then it turns into a full blown binge. And now you wiped out the entire cake or tray of brownies or, you know, whatever it might be. And then you're going to feel guilty and ashamed and horrible. And then you're going to ricochet back the other direction of, I was so bad, I need to be strict. And then the cycle repeats itself.
Right.
So honestly, it can be a worthwhile prescription to just have a dessert or a piece of junk food like 2-3 times a week.
Yeah, I agree. And it's just tasty and delicious, you know?
You know? Hey, we're only on this rock hurling through space once, as far as I can tell. We're not guaranteed another reincarnation on this rock, so I'm going to eat the chocolate. I don't know.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and I wanted to talk about something else, too. And this is just generally how people are looking at progress. Because I think sometimes, in my clients at least, and some are more guilty of this than others, or kind of more prone to this, I shouldn't say guilty, but more prone to this kind of thinking. You know, the mindset of, when my gut issues are gone, or I'm making progress only when I'm not having gut issues. Mm. Instead of looking at it, it's hard to go from all these gut issues to zero gut issues.
Yeah.
There has to be some realistic expectations in terms of what progress looks like, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And sometimes reminding yourself of that. One way to think of this is, you know, looking at things from a month-to-month standpoint. I know I've talked about before how I sometimes will have clients do, like, good gut day journals, or even, like, a tally. So, like, you can tally up, you know, how many good gut, better than average gut days, good gut days you have in a month.
Yeah.
But I almost think, like, progress oftentimes, not always, like, there's some people that make big strides quicker than others, and some people that are a little bit slower. We have to get different foundational pieces squared away. But even looking, like, across months, how you're improving over months' time versus, like, day-to-day, you know, I'm sure you have clients where it's like, well, I tried this thing for 2 days, and I don't think it's working. But it's something that is going to take some time. Or like, oh, ate more food and it's not helping. And it's like, well, how have you, I've been doing it for a week. And it's like, well, you need to do it longer than a week to get the changes. So I think sometimes people are overly focused on the finish line of like the symptoms very well controlled. And that can create problems, because I think sometimes people are overly focused on the goalpost and less focused on the systems that create the end goal. So they're constantly like tracking, clocking where they're at from a day-to-day basis, where I think you're almost better off tracking stuff like that from like a month to month basis. Like if you are checking in on progress and instead focusing on like each day, what can I do today to create a better gut day or better gut health tomorrow? Like focusing day to day on the systems, like the different tasks you can cross off that you can do on a day to day basis. And maybe you don't hit them every single day, but like,
but there's some effort.
Right. Like, what am I doing each day to help create a better tomorrow for my gut?
Yeah.
But it's like focusing on the day to day versus like the end process of like, when am I going to be better? Like which again, everyone wants to be better. And I think that's not a bad thing to wonder, but it's like, the more I think you can focus on specific tasks you can do day to day and focus on, again, what can I do today to create a better gut kind of down the road?
Yeah.
But I'm going to focus on these tasks today. And, you know, I might not see immediate change from those things, but it's going to build up over time.
It's kind of like keeping the faith, sort of like keeping the faith that if you are diligent and you're trying to stack these good, healthy things day after day after day, that the net trend is going to be favorable.
Yeah, it's really funny. Have you read Atomic Habits by James Clear?
No.
Another good book, but he gives an example that's really interesting about like a stone cutter, or like a guy that's beaten on a stone to try to break it up. I don't know if it's like a stone cutter or like a stone banger. I don't know what it's called. Not? But basically the example is, you have a guy that's hammering a stone and nothing happens after 100 clacks of the hammer, and the 101st clack, the stone breaks open.
Yeah.
But it takes 100 whacks of the hammer to get to that one point. And he terms like that part, in terms of establishing habits, is called like the valley of disappointment. You're like putting in all this time and effort and you're like, oh, like I'm not necessarily seeing a massive change yet.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people will sometimes struggle to remain committed to their daily goals in that time frame, because they're not to the point where they're getting tons of feedback, positive feedback yet. And they haven't necessarily, maybe they're 50 swacks in of the hammer and they're just not quite there where they're seeing a major breakthrough. And that's something to think about too, is like staying committed to the process in the daily goals that you have laid out, even when you're not necessarily seeing the biggest changes yet, can be really important.
I actually have another kind of nugget to share too, very similar to what you just described. Hold on, let me find it. All right, yeah, I came across it years ago now. I forget where I saw this, but it's the same kind of general concept. Another way to look at it is somewhere I read this, to remember to finish your bridges. And the analogy was like, if you're trying to get from point A to point B and you build 30% of a bridge, you're going to look at the bridge and be like, son of a gun, it doesn't work. Ah, this wasn't the right bridge. And you're going to give up and potentially bag it.
Yeah.
Similarly, you know, if you want to get from one island to the next island or whatever it might be, if you complete 91% of the bridge, you have not made it to that island. You haven't made it to that goal. So you could get that close potentially and be like, ah, this bridge doesn't work. I'm going to try something else. You know, I'm going to go try acupuncture instead. And, or I'm going to go try this other SIBO diet instead. And it's like, it's going to look like the bridge doesn't get you there until it gets you there.
Right.
Is kind of the way to think of it. You know, like, why am I not cured yet? Why am I not better yet? Well, because you're not done with that. You didn't see it through to fruition. Right. But I actually like the stone metaphor even better. I think that paints an even better picture. And also I think too, like a lot of people, we all lose sight of day-to-day progress that's small. It's like weight loss, right? Mm-hmm. Like you could lose 1 pound a day for a month and you probably won't notice it until you have an external cue, like your pants are looser or, you know, looser, your dresses fit nicer, your favorite sweater fits better. But it's not until you have that external cue that you realize the progress you've made. Or if you go out and like a coworker or a friend is like, wow, you really look fantastic. Have you lost weight? And then you're like, oh, wow, I guess I have. Cool. But like, even though we live in this body and we are making progress every day, if it's gradual progress every single day, we can be really oblivious to it. And the same thing can happen with bad stuff too, right? Like you can get more and more fatigued or more and more sick and not really be consciously aware of it until you're really sick, and then it's more urgent. But I like the idea of tracking good gut health days and tracking the good days, because then it'll give you the ability to be a bit more objective and look back and be like, oh yeah, like look at, you know, September versus October versus November. Oh, I'm doing a lot better. Look, I had one good gut health day in September, and then I had 5 in October, and then I had 20 good days in November. Holy crap, that's amazing.
Right. Yeah, and I think it also helps the person too, because I've had some people who like maybe they get off to a really great start, or like maybe they're doing really well and they have kind of what they consider like a fluky day where it's like, oh, I had a bad gut day today. Like, is the SIBO back? Like, it can kind of cause you to spiral versus, like, if you look at it in the context of a month, yes, you can see where you're at with good days, but there's not necessarily this expectation that, like, your gut's totally resilient yet.
Yeah.
And maybe if we can unpack, sometimes I'll unpack, like, maybe what happened that, like, was there anything in that day? And we can kind of unpack if there was anything in particular, or if it was just, like, maybe your gut's just not quite resilient yet, and we're still on the road, and again, you even looking at good gut days, you're still having more good gut days than bad, and the progress is still there. But I think sometimes when people are like on a really good trend and they have, you know, a day or two of like an upset gut, and it's like, oh no, like I'm back to where, like it's easy to get
back to where I started,
right? Like catastrophize almost, like oh gosh, absolutely. I'm And that can create some problems, I think, mentally too. But just having the expectation of, you know, on a good gut journey, or like on your gut journey, you're not necessarily going to have all, like, it's going to go from, you know, tons of bad gut days to all good gut days. There's probably a little bit of like some ups and downs in there, and, you know,
that's a
don't
good
let
point.
Yeah, don't necessarily let a couple bad days when you're generally the general trend is progress make you think like you're back at square one.
Yeah. That's actually a good point, is that I think for whatever reason in a lot of our minds, and I'm probably guilty of this too, we have this image or this expectation of like in a healing journey. Well, A, we think it's going to be linear, and it never is, but it's like, oh, Like, the progression is going to be bad, 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 medium, 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 cured.
Right, right, right.
And, like, you know, it's like there's distinct phases and a distinct linear progression. When, like, what you're saying now, it's like you're going to have really good days and really bad days and kind of medium days and kind of squirrely days all mixed in. And it's about the ratio of good versus bad days, you know, each week, each month, each year, that really is going to paint the picture of your current situation. I will also say, I have another metaphor. This is a very, like, metaphor laden episode right now. So another one I like that I heard, and so I use this quite a lot with my patients, is you can kind of imagine if you're symptomatic right now, whether your symptoms are, you know, lots of food intolerances, bloating, constipation, diarrhea, headaches, whatever it is, being symptomatic is kind of like you're in a ditch or a rut in a way, or like, or maybe if you want to be more dramatic, it's like you fell off a cliff. And the goal is to get you out of that ditch, out of that rut, or over back on top of that cliff, and then get you the heck away from the cliff. Right. Mm-hmm. So, like, I think in our brains, in this metaphor, as long as our feet are on solid ground, as long as we are standing upright on the ground, that's us perceiving that we are asymptomatic, or we feel like we're pretty healthy if our feet are on solid ground. But the minute we go off the edge of the cliff and we're hanging on by our fingernails, that's when we perceive the symptoms.
Right.
And I think people are generally much better at perceiving the difference between dangling off the edge of the cliff versus feet on solid ground again. But we're not very good at perceiving the difference between feet on solid ground, but we're an inch away from that cliff edge.
Right.
Or feet are on solid ground and we're a mile away from the cliff. Mm-hmm. And that's where resilience comes in. It's like, initially, when you heal, quote unquote, and you get yourself out of that ditch, initially, you're going to be right next to the ditch on some level. Like, your microbiome is still going to be a little bit off. Your motility might be a little bit compromised. You know, you're teetering on the edge of something, but you've pulled yourself out of it enough that you're starting to feel better. And then any little bullshit thing, like one day that's stressful, or one bad night of sleep, or one serving size too much of asparagus, or whatever it is going to just pink, and over the edge you go. And then you're like, no, the SIBO's back. Right. I'm sick again. I had healed myself. Damn it. What am I going to do? Right. And it's like, well, yeah, because you just got to the point where you were less, you know, you were asymptomatic or less symptomatic, but you were still right there. So we need to work together long enough that we get you the hell away from the cliff so that you never go back there. And that's in part why, like, I only really work with people for 6 months at a time. Because I'm like, look, I think I could get you feeling substantially better or even asymptomatic sooner than this. But I want to make sure I give myself the ability to really work on other stuff and kind of fine tune at the end so that I know when I leave you to go live your life, I want to know that you're well away from that cliff and you're not going to go back there anytime soon. And hopefully you have the tools and the maps to navigate away from that cliff again.
So. Right. Well, and I think that part of this comes into, like, trauma brain too. Like, we've talked about, like, the trauma, like, of having these gut issues. And when it comes to, like, some clients that I have too, it's like, what's your new normal? Like, I think a normal person might have some days where their gut feels a little bit off. Maybe, like, you know, they overindulged on alcohol in the weekend or something like that, and their gut just does not feel right. Or, like,
or they got super stressed and they had diarrhea.
Right, right. So I think that sometimes, like, understanding there's going to be a new normal too, of, like, a healthy person can sometimes have changes in their gut too.
Yep.
So, like, what does that look like? And I think sometimes it's going to take some experimentation to, like, minimize any of those circumstances, but they're still going to come up at times to where your gut might be a little bit off. And I think it's really natural to maybe have some trauma and things like that come up in those situations. Yep. But I think over time it gets better. But just acknowledging, like, oh, even a healthy person has changes in their gut function, and not using like using a rule of like no symptoms ever as your guidepost for if you're still doing well gut-wise.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good point. Again, it's like this this illusion of what it means to be healed or what it means to be healthy or what it means to be happy, to get even more like, you know, off on a tangent potentially. But I think also this is a quirk of the human brain. I think we're always striving for something. Like, most of us will never be 100% satisfied with our life or our health or our job. Like, even, you know, you could think of it as like the person who's like, okay, I'm just going to use like career stuff because that's easier, I feel like, to wrap the head around. But like, okay, my first goal is to go to college and I'll be happy once I graduate college. Okay. Right. Then the person graduates college and it's like, okay, I'm going to be happy once I get a job. And then they get a job and then they're like, okay, this job is really tough and I have to work 800 hours a week, but I'm going to climb the ladder. I'm going to put in a few really hard years at this job and then I'm going to get a promotion. I will be happy when I get the promotion. Hmm. And then they get the promotion and then it's like, okay, all right, I don't have to work 800 hours a week, so I'm doing better, but I need another promotion or I need that raise. I will be happy and I will, you know, I will do this thing for myself when I get the raise. And I've got news for you. It continues on. Like, I know people who make a shitload of money. Like, there's no two ways about this. I know people who make a lot of money and who never healed their mindset issues, and they are not in good mental health. And despite having a shit ton of money, they are still very unhappy and they feel like they're still striving for the next best thing.
Right.
You've got to keep that in check and just have some level of happiness or satisfaction where you're at if you're ever going to be happy or satisfied. Because we keep doing this to ourselves until the day we die. And it's asinine. And I do this to some degree too, I'm sure. But the same thing can happen with health. Like, oh, I will feel, I'll be able to live my life. I'll be able to go to that, you know, that vacation. I'll be able to play basketball. I'll be able to do this when my gut is healthy, when I'm not bloated, when I can have good poops or whatever it is. And then you just pick something else to chase after. And then it's this rat race that we never get out of.
Right. And I love that you're bringing this up because I think a better guidepost, it's not necessarily that you never have symptoms ever again. Like, I never have any gut symptoms ever again. A better guidepost would be that you're able to live the life that you want to live, that you're able to pursue your passions, that you're able to set goals for yourself that aren't health-wise, that you can, like, be present in the moment and not thinking about gut stuff. Like, those are the things that should be your guidepost. It's not that you'll never have a symptom ever again, and that's the guidepost of a healthy gut. It's more that this isn't something that's consuming so much of your time, energy, thoughts, that it's preventing you from doing the things that you love and pursuing the things that you're interested in.
And it's also worth noting, it's not that you never have goals again, and it's not that you never have ambition and motivation again. It's just, there's a balance, right? Like, you can live your life trying to fill a void with achievements and accolades and, you know, crossing things off a list. Enneagram type to get back to the Enneagram again. But like, you could be like the achiever and still, you know, you can go to college, you can go to medical school, you can fly to the moon for all I care. You can do the things. Just, you don't want to make that your entire existence on this planet. And you don't, and this came up with another patient yesterday, a different patient. The idea of your self-identity and your ego can be really complex too. Like, I was talking with another favorite patient yesterday, and there's a lot that comes up of like his job and achieving and achieving and being tough and persevering. And there, it was kind of this reoccurring theme. And finally I asked him, I was like, let me ask, would you say that you've constructed your self-identity or your feeling of worth around this idea that you're really tough or really hardworking or you persevere or you overcome hardship. Because, and he immediately, he was like, oh, yeah. And I was like, yeah, because that could be a slippery slope.
Right.
Like, and this is a guy, you know, we've talked already, we've only had two appointments together, but we've already talked a lot about like mental health, and his gut issues were preceded by a lot of stress. And, you know, we talked about that a lot as a root cause. And I was like, you know, as somebody who I think has very crispy adrenals, like very, very stressed person, and now he's dealing with this health stuff, I was like, this could be a big piece of your healing journey. Because honestly, theoretically, if I could wave a magic wand and totally cure your gut today, would you immediately go right back into work, working way too many hours, and burn yourself out again and stress yourself out to the point where your condition just came right back? Because like that's worthy of your exploration right now before we heal your gut completely. Because, you know, it's one thing to get you out of the ditch. It's another thing to prevent you from going back in the same ditch twice.
Right.
And I think, you know, there is some degree of that I'll see sometimes where it's like people can sometimes ascribe so much of their self-worth and their identity around this idea of being hardworking and being, you know, somebody who overcomes things and can persevere and push through. And, you know, I have a friend, like, she's told me, I don't even know how many times, well, we're workers. Like, my husband and I, we've always held down, you know, at least two jobs, and we work our ass off. And, like, the way she's talked about it, it's like, oh, that's part of your identity that you've built for yourself. So what happens then when that same friend opens, it's a chiropractor friend, like, what happens when that chiropractor friend opens up a business? And, you know, are you going to kill yourself working 90-hour work weeks because you've told yourself, I'm a worker, I'm a worker? And then you burn yourself into the ground until your body can no longer cope? Like, because that's a very real thing that happens, and it's scary when it does. I think my mom's like that, and that's why she'll work herself to death until she gets a huge wake-up call from her body. For example, a giant bleeding ulcer when she lost 50% of her blood all in a day. Her hemoglobin dropped down to 6 in the ER.
Oh my gosh.
And it was like, That's so nuts. Your body's telling you something. That's all I got. I got nothing else. But just be aware of that kind of stuff, because it can be a slippery slope.
I totally agree. That's such a good point.
Especially for those who have crispy adrenals.
Yes. Yes. We've been guilty of that a time or two, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got nothing else to add. Probably if I did have something to add, it would be too long-winded at this stage of the podcast. I mean, there's got to be like two people listening to us now. They're like, man, they've been talking about this forever. But I hope that was a good episode. Honestly, like, this has been kind of one of my favorite episodes in a way, because we were able to explore so many different concepts and so many different things and pull out so many different tips and tricks as it relates to mental health, mindset, and just the healing in general. Honestly, I don't even know what to call the episode anymore. I don't know if mindset is going to be the appropriate title. We'll have to marinate on that a little bit later on. Yeah. But, you know, I think that there's so many different angles that we could approach healing from, and there's so many different angles that we could approach mental health from, and like mindset and healing. And I hope that this episode gave you something new to utilize.
Yeah, I think you're right. I feel that so much of the discussion is around manipulating physiology in some way, or like, you know, all the strategies that do that. Right. And not necessarily the mental side of things. I feel like usually takes a back seat. You know, it might come up here or there in the SIBO space, but it's not something that's really discussed often.
Yeah.
And I think as we've been mentioning, it's such a big part of our own clients' journeys, and it deserves to be in the mix. And for some people, it's like the majority of the healing has to be the mental side of things and where you're at, where your mentality's at in order for you to make progress. So I'm glad we were able to discuss it. I think this is a great episode. I'm glad we were able to touch on a lot of different points.
Absolutely. New fave. And gang. watch out on the Instagrams, by the way, because A, Amy and I are both making amazing reels. I can't tell you how many times I rewatched your FODMAP gangster video.
Oh my God.
Like, I crack up at that. So first of all, look at our reels because they're hysterical. We are funny ladies. But also,
I love your reels.
Thank you. I'm having way too much fun with them, honestly. Like, now I'm too far gone to turn back. I don't think I'll ever do a normal feed post again. The reels are too fun. But what I was going to share too is that we have talked about it a bit, and we never really got into a good rhythm with doing Q&A episodes for the podcast because we want to talk about this stuff and we want to kind of freelance it. And Lord knows we have topics like this where we talk and talk and talk for an hour and a half. And what we've decided to do instead is do the Q&A segments in an Instagram live video. I think if we could do it once a week or so, that would be great, at least until we kind of run out of questions. And then maybe people will chime in live. But keep your eyes peeled for that. I think we're going to aim to do those on Wednesdays, it sounds like, or maybe we'll mix it up on occasion, but keep your eyes peeled on both of our Instagram accounts for one of us to host a live video and then have the other one in the video as well. So I think we'll have to figure it out. I don't know how to do an Instagram live, but by golly, we're going to figure it out. And then you guys can chat with us live and we'll start working our way through some of the questions from the YouTube comments and the emailed questions, because admittedly we're a little bit backlogged on that. So stay tuned on Instagram.
Yep. So Amy, you get what you get. What you get with the IBS Freedom Podcast.
Exactly. That's our slogan now. So my Instagram handle is Triangle Guts, plural with an S at the end, because I'm in the Triangle of North Carolina. Amy, is it Amy_Hollenkamp_RD, I think?
Correct. That's correct.
There we go. I'm a stalker, that's why I know that. So now you know, and you can check out the Q&A videos, and we're probably going to have all sorts of nuggets and random tangents on those Q&As, truthfully, so I already look forward to those as well. But as always, guys, we will see you in the next episode of the IBS Freedom Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you are on right now, let's see, we are 1 hour and 48 minutes in. Whoever is listening to this, will you drop a comment down below, because you're a hero. But honestly, I really hope this episode was helpful, and we will see you right back here, same time, same place, on the podcast to talk more about things that affect your gut health and ultimately will help you heal.